Astonishing Legends Network.
Welcome back to the show, and happy Valentine's Day weekend. Look, Valentine's Day is a big deal for me and Susan. It's one of our anniversaries. We have like 5 anniversaries. We have first date, first sex, first good sex. Maybe getting married is one of them. I honestly can't remember. But we always end up celebrating Valentine's Day. So here's the thing about Valentine's Day. If you're with somebody, a partner, a girlfriend, a boyfriend, husband, wife, don't blow this off. Don't do that thing where you go, oh, this is a big scam. This is just about restaurants making money and florists selling flowers. Of course it is. But that's not a reason to not do something. And by something, I mean have sex. If you're able to have sex and you can have sex with somebody who wants to have sex with you, do it. I mean, if it's your partner, not if it's just a person who you, well, I mean, I suppose it could be a person you just met. But you know what I'm trying to say? As long as everyone's cool with it and no one's getting hurt. But wait, you say, no, I don't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a husband or a wife. So what am I supposed to do on Valentine's Day? Because that sucks. Well, I'm the kind of guy that's going to tell you that Valentine's Day is a celebration of love. So, what do you got? A dog, a cat, a bird, whatever. Great. Do something nice for them. Buy them a little treat. Play with them. Spend some time with them. Curl up on the couch with them. God forbid you've got a child. Okay, that's fine. If you love your child, do something with them. If you love them, that's frankly up to you. Finally, maybe best of all, love yourself. Do something nice for yourself. Or if you're alone, you got no pets, you got no kids, you got no partner, you're on your own, great. Order in your favorite food. Don't worry about what anyone else likes. Get your favorite food. Get a ton of it. Watch your favorite movie, favorite TV shows. Finally, walk into a bookstore and allow yourself to spend a little bit too much money on books. You're allowed to spend too much money on books. God knows that. Be good to yourself. Buy every book you want. Susan and I, we have plans. We're going to turn the lights down low, open a bottle of tequila or something, light some candles, and work on our podcasts. All right, now that you're all set for a sexy romantic weekend, let's talk about plane crashes. Here we go. The Ghost of Flight 401 by John G. Fuller. Eastern Airlines Flight 401 crashed just before midnight on December 29, 1972. Several minor and completely avoidable problems cropped up in the cockpit simultaneously, and it was the combination of these problems and the flight crew's attempt to address them that resulted in the L-1011 Whisperliner plunging into the Everglades, 20 miles outside Miami International Airport. Of the 176 people aboard the plane that night, 101 died. Of the 75 survivors, many were gravely injured and found themselves desperately trying to avoid drowning in a pitch-black swamp that was now awash in thousands of gallons of jet fuel. Captain Bob Loft died shortly after impact. Second Officer Don Repo was rescued from the wreckage but died days later of his injuries. Loft and Repo were the pilot and co-pilot of the airplane. As the cause of the crash was painstakingly reconstructed over the ensuing weeks and months, the cause would finally be blamed on pilot error. John G. Fuller's book, The Ghost of Flight 401, Putnam Publishing Group, 1976, is the story of the crash itself, and then the author's personal journey following up on claims that numerous employees of Eastern Airlines had personally seen, and in some cases interacted with, the ghosts of Bob Loft and Don Repo. What made these stories so unique and compelling is that all of them took place on a modern L-1011 jumbo jet. Haunted houses, sure, we've all heard of that, but haunted passenger jets? This was something truly novel. A ghost story for the modern age. John Fuller does a great job of pulling you along with him as he hops onto flight after flight, casually chatting up the ladies serving him scotch on the rocks about whether anything strange has happened to them down in the galley. Sure, he's asking about ghosts, not the Mile High Club, but still. It's a sexy, scary story, the best kind. And by the end, he's enlisted the help of no fewer than 4 different Eastern Airline employees to help him with his research. At a certain point, a woman named Elizabeth Manzioni becomes his main accomplice, and it's no great surprise to learn that after the writing of this book, they got married. Now, don't get me wrong, in the 1970s, there were plenty of reasons aside from ghosts to be afraid of air travel. Crashes were far more common, and for a span of 10 years, hijackings were becoming an almost weekly occurrence. During the peak period from 1968 to 1972, there were over 130 hijackings in the U.S. alone. But even with all this, back then, air travel was considered a luxury. I remember airlines advertising based on their competing levels of comfort, courtesy, and overall dedication to pampering passengers. In fact, once you got to the airport, your vacation was already underway. The design and operation of the airport was aimed at making you feel like you were entering an exclusive club that got progressively more exclusive as you made your way from the ticketing counter to the terminal, to the gate, and finally onto the airplane. The public address announcements were quiet and reassuring. Questions, problems, or requests were greeted with calm smiles. After all, you paid good money for your ticket. Why shouldn't you be treated as a valued customer? Boarding the plane felt like entering a luxury hotel. There was an air of excitement. People were happy and dressed up. That's right, people used to dress up to travel by air, a holdover from the days of the blimp and the Zeppelin. The seats were wide and comfortable. The flight attendants, wait, it's the 1970s, I mean stewardesses, made sure there was a drink and a pack of cigarettes in your hand immediately. Instead of just saying the words, they actually wanted you to have a pleasant flight, and they wanted to know what they needed to do to make that happen. Unlike now, when airlines regard you more like a head of cattle that has been granted the gift of speech and bipedal locomotion and has somehow wandered onto one of their aircraft. I'm tempted to single out a particular airline as the worst, but really, aren't they all equally terrible? I haven't taken a single flight in the last 15 years in which I didn't feel as if the airline would vastly prefer that, because I have a choice, I choose any other airline but theirs. I arrive at the airport pre-browbeaten, the way you feel when you have to go to the DMV or the principal's office. The airline workers make it clear. They don't want to be there, and frankly, you being there isn't helping. Why did you pack your bags too heavy? Why are you setting off our metal detectors? Why are you boarding out of order? Why are you doing everything wrong? Their attitude seems to be, flying these airplanes would be a lot easier if it weren't for all you goddamn people climbing on and off every time we land. But fine, if you insist on inconveniencing us, the least you could do is hurry up. The sooner you cram yourself into your narrow seat and order a $21 chicken wrap, the sooner we can crash this thing into a mountain. But I digress. John Fuller first heard about ghosts showing up on Eastern Airlines L-1011s while on a Scandinavian Airlines flight in March of 1974, just about 14 months after the crash of Flight 401. It came up in a conversation with a stewardess after Fuller mentioned that he was an author and had published a book about the Betty and Barney Hill UFO abduction, The Interrupted Journey, Dial Press, 1966, and a book about a Brazilian peasant who performed psychic surgery, Arrigo, Surgeon of the Rusty Knife, Thomas Y. Crowell Company, 1974. UFOs and psychic surgery? This guy sure knows how to bait the hook. Anyway, the stewardess leans in confidentially and sets down a couple tiny bottles of Courvoisier. I'm elaborating now, but just go with it. And she shares a story she's heard. Ghosts of the Flight 401 pilots have been seen on certain Eastern airline flights. The stories have been circulating for over a year. Pretty much every flight crew on every airline has heard about it. Fuller asks her a very smart question. Why haven't the ghost reports shifted from Eastern Airlines to, say, Scandinavian Airlines? Or any other airline for that matter? After all, folklore tends to morph and bend to appeal to the locals. The stewardess responded, quote, "That thought is very interesting. Perhaps the story doesn't change because it actually happened on Eastern." That's my Scandinavian accent for some reason. Now, that wasn't enough to get John Fuller to throw down the project he was currently working on, a book about the partial nuclear meltdown of the Enrico Fermi atomic reactor near Detroit, Michigan. See, he didn't only write weird shit. But about a month later, quite by coincidence, Fuller found himself having dinner with three other couples, among which there were no less than four employees of Eastern Airlines. They too had heard the ghost stories, all from the people who had actually experienced them. No one was laughing or joking about it, no one was rolling their eyes, and no one was throwing shade on their coworkers who claimed to have had a supernatural experience. Now, that alone was weird. But a couple of strange new details were added to the mystery. One theory floating around was that the ghosts were only sighted on airplanes that contained reused, non-structural items that had been salvaged from the wreckage of Flight 401. There was a story written up in Flight Safety Foundation, a newsletter sponsored by a group of aviation insurance companies, which reminds me, I've got to renew my subscription, about the ghost of Don Repo actually warning someone of a possible fire risk on a particular jet. From the newsletter, quote, "A flight attendant was in the lower galley of the airplane when she happened to glance into the glass window of one of the meal heating units. There, looking out at her, was the face of Don Repo, the flight engineer that had lost his life in the Everglades crash. Mystified, the flight attendant went topside and asked another stewardess to go below. She did and verified what the girl had seen. The two of them then asked the flight engineer of their flight crew to go below, and he did, and not only saw, but talked to the vision, or ghost if you will, who said, 'Watch out for fire on this airplane.' Shortly thereafter, a fire developed in one of the big jumbo jet's engines. It was only through the flight crew's almost unbelievable expertise and handling of the big jet were they able to come around and land safely on one engine, never having gotten any higher than 400 feet above ground level." Could it be true? Did Don Repo's ghost appear on an Eastern Airlines L-1011 for the sole purpose of warning the flight crew of possible problems on the aircraft? These details stuck with Fuller long enough to convince him there might be more to the story. He started out by visiting the FAA so he could research exactly what happened on the night of December 29, 1972. Maybe the facts of that doomed flight would shed light on the strange events that were to follow. Supernatural events that began less than 2 months after the tragic crash of Flight 401. I never had a problem with airplanes until July 12th, 2002. Up until then, for me, flying was fun. When I was a kid, we never flew anywhere because my mom was terrified of airplanes. Meanwhile, everyone we knew was flying everywhere all the time, and I was incredibly jealous. It seemed so fancy. To me, if you got to fly on an airplane, that made you special. You were important. You were rich. And so, of course, the opposite must be true as well. If your vacation didn't involve an airport, and ours never did, then to me, it wasn't much of a vacation. It was smaller, cheaper, lesser. On Friday night, July 12th, 2002, I was at LAX, and I was in a good mood. I was flying to Las Vegas for a weekend of fun. It was a guys-only trip, which meant plenty of eating, drinking, gambling, and yes, strip clubs. Susan has always said there's not a woman on earth who understands the appeal of strip clubs, including the strippers. She might be right, but back then I was in my mid-30s and newly single, and I just had my first TV show picked up to series. Let's face it, I was a big shot. I deserved Vegas. I deserved strip clubs. I deserved cold gin and hot girls and casinos that made me feel like the unholy love child of James Bond and Charlie Sheen. I deserved something. It was time for life to start being fun. Irresponsible, stupid, fun. The kind I'd never really had before. Was something gonna happen in Vegas that would have to stay in Vegas? Probably not. But for this weekend, I wanted to feel like it could. I got to the airport early, and I did something I'd never done before. I had a martini at the bar before my flight. I felt very sophisticated. My friend, Jeff Dreher, who was flying with me, showed up just as I was finishing it off. Starting early, he said. And it took me a second to realize he wasn't making fun of me. He was impressed. We boarded the plane, tossed our backpacks into the overhead storage bins, and plopped into our seats. I looked around. It seemed like there was an alarming number of attractive young women all around us. Was it just my imagination? Jeff saw the look on my face and explained. Professional strippers from Los Angeles would often fly to Vegas for the weekend to make extra cash, then fly back on Sunday morning, just like us. Now I was impressed. How did Jeff know this? I'm a dermatologist, he said. I know a lot of strippers. It was true. He was a dermatologist. Jeff and I knew each other because we were both in the same writers group. I never thought about it, but now it made sense. In Los Angeles, a dermatologist would see a lot of strippers, and actresses, and models, and dancers, and newscasters, and really anyone whose career depended upon flawless skin, which in LA was just about everyone but writers. I didn't really know Jeff all that well. In fact, among our group of writers, I knew him hardly at all. But what did that matter? When you were traveling to Las Vegas with someone, all you really needed to know is that they wanted to go to Vegas as much as you did, and for all the same reasons. That automatically evened the playing field. Everyone was equally implicated by their own secret desires. Some of us were looking forward to getting drunk. Others were looking forward to getting high. Most of us planned to risk a good portion of our weekly salary gambling. And then, of course, there were the strip clubs where we would help women, most of them at least 10 years younger than us, put down payments on their second condos. It was a win-win-lose-win-win situation. The flight from Los Angeles to Las Vegas is a short one, just about an hour and 15 minutes. And you can always expect a little turbulence at the end as you're coming in for a landing at McCarran Airport. Tonight was no different, except that the turbulence started about halfway through the flight. The captain came on and explained that there was a sandstorm over the Las Vegas airport and that from here on out, passengers would have to remain seated with our seatbelts fastened. He didn't sound nervous, so I didn't get nervous. And as it turned out, he was correct. The turbulence grew worse and worse, and then worse, and then something weird happened. The entire inside of the cabin began to turn dark red. Everyone looked out the windows, I did too, but there was nothing to see. No clouds, no mountains, no Vegas, just an odd red glow. It was sand, the sandstorm. It was like everyone on the plane realized it at the exact same instant. We were in the middle of it, like a mile-high red tornado. And as we all realized it, maybe even because we all realized it, the turbulence suddenly got a hell of a lot worse. It was so bad, it felt like there should be a different word for it beyond turbulence. Disturbulence. Terribulence. Deathulence. The captain burped some words over the PA, and the flight attendants strapped themselves into their seats, looking grim and unsure. Loud banging sounds erupted up and down the body of the airplane, and you could feel the engine straining against the force of the wind. The overhead bins flew open, and luggage, including ours, tumbled into the aisle. Someone shouted. I'm pretty sure it wasn't me. I had gone deep inside myself to a place I'd never been before. One part of my brain kept telling me that it was extremely unlikely that I was going to die. But at the same time, I was aware that something had changed in my body. The mental membrane that I had constructed on every plane trip I had ever been on was suddenly torn. That little membrane that reassured me that I was basically safe, that the worst was never really gonna happen. But now, whether it was going to happen or not, I suddenly realized that it could happen. And I was getting a taste of how it would feel if it did. I felt completely helpless. I started praying the way people who don't typically pray do. My request was put out in general to any supernatural force that could hear me and might want to help. Please, please don't let this plane crash. Just please. The plane suddenly dropped. 10 feet, 100 feet. One of the flight attendants yelped, but there was no reassuring burst of laughter. No one was laughing. No one was talking. It was deathly silent, except for the sound of the straining engines and the banging sounds up and down the fuselage. We were all concentrating on keeping the plane in the air. This was no longer a pleasant Friday night flight to Vegas. This was about survival. After what seemed like an improbably long time, the captain's voice came back on the PA and he explained the situation. After two unsuccessful attempts, he was informed by the tower in Las Vegas that the winds would not allow for a safe landing at McCarran Airport. So, we would be returning to, quote, the Los Angeles area. But because there was a fuel issue, we wouldn't be flying all the way back to LAX. We would land at Ontario International Airport, refuel, and then make another attempt. There was an audible groan of disappointment from the other passengers. After a few minutes, the dark red glow inside the cabin began to fade to orange, then to yellow, then to nothing. The turbulence died down bit by bit as we flew west now instead of east, with fuel running low, heading to Ontario Airport. Jeff and I hadn't spoken for the last 20 minutes. He'd made a few jokes during the worst of it, but then I guess he saw my face and stopped trying. As we headed in for the landing, I turned to him and said, "Hey, I'm sorry, man, but I'm getting off the airplane. I'm not going through that again." In fact, at that moment, there was nothing in the world I wanted to do more than get off that airplane. All I needed to do was keep my shit together until we were safely on the ground. He said, "Absolutely, man, whatever you want to do." And I was relieved to see that as soon as we landed and it finally stopped, that a full third of the passengers were now lining up to get off. Jeff and I took our place behind them. I could feel myself calming down now that we were no longer in the air. But the line in front of us wasn't moving. I asked the person in front of me if they had opened the doors yet. The person in front of me was young and blonde and had flawless skin. A stripper, obviously, with an excellent dermatologist. She informed me that she was actually in line for the restroom. I looked up and realized that everyone in front of me was in line for the restroom. And just like that, I started to panic again. Was I the only person who wanted to get off the airplane? There was no one lined up behind me, so I headed straight to the back of the plane and asked one of the flight attendants if they'd be opening the doors. She looked at me like I was crazy and said, "Of course not." "Oh no," I thought. "They're not going to open the doors? They're not going to let anyone off?" It was one of those moments when two great fears collide: dying in an airplane crash or making a scene in public. I chose the latter. I need to get off this plane. What happened up there? I just need to get off. The flight attendant picked up the microphone attached to the wall and informed the pilot that, quote, "A man wants to get off the plane." I didn't like the way she said "man." Then she told me to wait a minute. Jesus Christ, I thought, I'm going to be that person. I'm going to be the person making a scene in public. Even worse, making a scene on a flight to Las Vegas packed with strippers. I noticed a commotion up ahead. It was a man in uniform pushing his way downstream against the line of people headed toward the bathroom. He looked at the flight attendant, then at me, then back at the flight attendant. There was a slight nod between them, and then he said, "Sir, is there a problem?" "Is there a problem? Yeah, we almost died in a sand tornado. Was it really that crazy that I wanted to get off the plane?" I explained to him that the whole situation had freaked me out, and I really needed to get off the plane. I try to remain calm enough not to sound crazy, but upset enough to make it clear that I wasn't going to back down. His next question surprised me. Did you check any luggage? I didn't understand why he was asking me that. But then suddenly it was like a thought bubble appeared above his head. If you planted a bomb on this airplane and now you're trying to get off, you can forget about it. You're going to have to sit right here and blow up with the rest of us, you fucking terrorist. No, Jeff told him. We didn't check any luggage. The uniformed guy looked at Jeff and said, "Are you getting off with him?" Jeff said, "Absolutely." And in that moment, Jeff Dreyer became my best friend in the world. "Hang on," the uniformed man said, and he began fighting his way back to the front of the plane. Now Jeff and I just stood there. It was becoming clear to everyone around us that there was a crazy person who, for some crazy reason, wanted to get off the plane. "He must be insane," I imagined them thinking. "He's not even willing to die to get to Vegas for the weekend. What kind of a sick fuck is he?" The flight attendant behind me picked up the PA, listened, said something back, then hung up. "All right, gentlemen," she said, "follow me." She looked upset, but not in an annoyed way, more like a stern and serious way, like we were forcing her to commit some huge breach of FAA conduct. And maybe we were. It was less than a year after 9/11, and a whole host of new rules and procedures had been introduced throughout the airline industry. Rules about when, or when not, to open the main cabin doors and let passengers on and off. We made our way past row after row of beautiful young women who all sat back looking bored, like nothing that could happen to them on this airplane could possibly be worse than whatever was waiting for them in the VIP lounge of the Spearmint Rhino. We finally reached the front of the plane where we were allowed to disembark. We were the only people who got off the airplane. I'm not proud of what I thought at that moment. "Fine," I thought. "I hope it crashes. Then you'll see. We were the smart ones, and all the headlines will read, 'Writer creator of ABC pilot miracles and stripper dermatologist demand to leave doomed flight minutes before tragic crash.'" Well, no planes crashed that night, in Vegas or anywhere else. Jeff and I rented a car in Ontario and drove to Vegas. We got in just before midnight. Everyone on that plane got there hours before us. And at 2 a.m. at Olympic Gardens, I wondered if any of the strippers working the floor recognized me as the crazy guy who scuttled off the plane, delaying their flight and their income just a little bit longer. You know the old saying, "For want of a nail, the kingdom was lost"? Eastern Airlines Flight 401 went down because of a 30-cent light bulb. It was just past 11:30 p.m. on December 29, 1972. Flight 401 was making its final approach to Miami International Airport. Captain Bob Loft had just given the order to First Officer Albert Stockstill to throw him out, which meant to lower the landing gear. Stockstill did. They all heard the usual grind and thump as the gears fell into place. But a moment later, Captain Loft noticed that only two of the three landing gear lights were on. It appeared that the nose gear had not descended properly. Loft informed ground control of the issue and was given permission to circle and reapproach. The landing gear was brought back up and then redeployed, but still the third light, confirming that the nose gear had descended, refused to come on. Here's where things get weird. Loft and Stockstill wonder if the problem is simply that the light is burned out. So Stockstill begins fiddling with it, trying to pull it out of its housing and then put it back in to see if it's working or burned out. But the light is in an awkward place from where he's sitting, and he can't quite get it to dislodge. For a moment or two, everyone seems focused on the insanely minor issue of getting the little light bulb out of its socket, but no one can quite seem to do it. The bulb is jammed. Finally, Second Officer Don Repo volunteers to go down into the disturbingly named hellhole to make a visual check of the landing gear. Maybe it is down and fully engaged, and the problem really is just a burned out light bulb. So Don Repo goes down into the hellhole, but comes right back up. He can't make a visual confirmation because it's too dark. At this point, Loft and Stockstill are 90% convinced that the nose gear is indeed down, having recycled the process themselves. But now, Angelo Donadeo, an L-1011 tech expert who happens to be on the flight and was invited to join the cockpit crew, volunteers to go down into the hellhole with Don Repo as an extra pair of eyes to see if he can help out. So, all this stuff is going on, but at the same time, something else is happening. Something that no one has noticed. It is now 11:41 p.m., and for the last 3 minutes, Flight 401 has been slowly losing altitude. The autopilot had been on, but a slight bump on the control column, which had gone unnoticed, had disengaged it. And because of the near constant discussion about the landing gear and the malfunctioning light, the black box voice recorder clearly shows that no one in the cockpit heard the soft alarm chime that signals a drop in altitude. Because the approach to Miami International Airport is routed directly over the Everglades, the darkness beneath the airplane is total. There are no obvious visual indicators of altitude outside of what is displayed on the instrument panel. And because of a disconnect between the pilot and the co-pilot's display readings, Stockstill's altitude indicator still displays the autopilot altitude of 2,000 feet, even though, in fact, the plane had now descended to below 1,000 feet. An air traffic controller in the Miami Tower saw a reading of 900 feet altitude for Flight 401, but momentary deviations in altitude on the radar display are apparently common, so the controller, who was busy tracking six other incoming flights, waited for another scan on the radar scope to verify the reading. At 11:42 p.m., the plane was only 600 feet above the swamp, and it was descending at a rate of 500 feet every 20 seconds. This exchange were the final words on the voice recorder later recovered from the crash. Quote, Stockstill. We did something to altitude. Loft. What? Stockstill. We're still at 2,000, right? Loft. Hey, what's happening here? Eastern Airlines Flight 401 crashed into the Florida Everglades 9 seconds later. The very next flight I took, after the one that scared me so bad, I was fine. But the one after that, I got a little worried. And with every flight after that, my anxiety grew and grew. I couldn't understand it. It didn't make sense. Finally, I checked in with my therapist, and he said that this was actually quite common, a delayed stress reaction. He also said that I had obviously internalized the fears of my mother. Great. Did this mean the cure was years away? Would I have to work through all of my mother's fears as well as my own before I emerged from therapy completely and 100% sane? By the following summer, I was coming up with reasons not to fly. Weren't there plenty of things to do and see within driving distance? By the fall of 2003, I knew I was in real trouble. My cousin was having a destination wedding in Hawaii. I should have been thrilled, but instead, I spent days dreading the flight, subconsciously coming up with reasons that I couldn't go. But I did, and I was miserable the whole time. Miserable on the flight there, and then miserable for the 5 days I was there, anticipating the flight back. I didn't understand what was wrong with me. Flying had never been a problem, and now it was, and it made me furious. It felt so unfair. Just when I wanted my life to open up and expand, this one problem was shutting it down. I had already suffered through the crippling fear and misery of a divorce. All the bad feelings were supposed to be behind me. I wanted to be off the leash, totally free. This was a problem I had to solve. Of course, there were others. As much as I wanted to be completely transformed by the freedom of my new single life, I also felt guilty and sad and scared. My therapist had said that separating from Michelle and becoming an independent person was a lot like separating from my mother during my adolescence, except for one very important detail. I hadn't separated from my mother during my adolescence. Normally, a teenager openly rebels against their parents. Apparently, it's an important rite of passage. You rebel, you act out, but then just as quickly you seek comfort, safety, and reassurance. It's the same thing toddlers do when they learn to walk and talk and explore their world. Get away from me, leave me alone, I can do it myself. Dovetailing with, I'm scared, where are you? Mommy and Daddy, I need help. Rebelling and then seeking reassurance within a matrix of safety and love was an important part of growing up mentally healthy, an essential psychological transition. Guess who skipped it? I never really rebelled against my mother or my father, certainly not in any overt way. I mean, I wanted to, I felt the impulse, but it was too scary, so I swallowed it down. I rebelled against rebellion. The very idea of getting in trouble with my parents, especially with my mom, was unthinkable. And trying to fight them, I would have been crushed. And at the same time, going to my mother for comfort for any reason was also unthinkable. Being vulnerable to her, seeking her out for reassurance, was the absolute last thing I would ever do. It just didn't feel safe. So, instead of going through this crucial transition, I made the unconscious decision to cut my mom and dad out of the equation of my life and simply parent myself, which required growing up fast. Sell a script, move out, become totally self-sufficient and independent. That is what would make me safe and healthy and strong. That would be my rebellion. Except it wasn't. My therapist explained that all it did was put it off. So instead of going through adolescence in my teens, I was now feeling a deep, compelling need to go through it in my 30s, which suited me just fine. In fact, this was preferable. Now that I was a mature, rational adult, I could be irresponsible safely and with little fear of consequence. A safe, controlled rebellion. What could go wrong? Well, for one thing, Susan Lambert. We started dating before my rebellion really got a foothold, and before I knew it, we were dangerously close to being in a committed relationship. We were exclusive, but we weren't engaged or anything. It had only been a couple of months. I mean, technically, I could fuck around. In fact, according to my plans, I should have been fucking around. That was the whole point of getting divorced. I didn't fuck around in my teens and 20s because I was with Michelle. So what was I doing being a one-woman guy now so soon after my divorce? Hell, I should be out getting laid all over town based on my Mothman prophecies cred. I mean, there had to be all kinds of women out there just dying to jump into bed with a guy who'd written a poorly received film based on the folklore of a mysterious flying humanoid. Why, yes, ladies, I did write the Mothman prophecies, but please don't all leave your boyfriends at once. I mean, sure, I know John Keel personally, and we have discussed his theories of ultra-terrestrials on occasion, but hey, please, put your clothes back on. That was the life I wanted. Or thought I wanted. I didn't want to be encumbered. I didn't want to be beholden to another woman because that was how I'd spent my entire life. Locked in too tight, taking care of someone. Now there was a voice telling me that the best revenge, rebellion, would be to sleep with a bunch of women and never feel like I had to take care of any of them. The thing I couldn't figure out was that Susan was somehow outside these thoughts. She was separate, siloed off somehow, a completely different experience. Right after Thanksgiving that year, Susan suggested that we take a trip to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, in January. We could rent a cabin, we could go skiing, go on a dog sled ride with real dogs. It sounded great. 2 days later, she told me she had booked our flight from LAX to Salt Lake City. 3 hours in an airplane flying over snow-covered mountains. And I wasn't scared at all. That cold, knife-twisting sensation in my stomach, that surge of adrenaline that drained my energy and left me feeling depleted and skinless and weak, that was excitement. In fact, I was so excited, so absolutely not terrified, I decided, fuck it. And I called Jeff and Hugh and Dan and Nick and Larry and as many other guys as I could think of and planned another trip to Las Vegas that weekend. By car, of course. Was I afraid of taking a trip with Susan? Getting deeper into a relationship that was still so new? Or was I afraid of getting on an airplane? I wasn't sure, but I felt certain that a weekend in Vegas would provide the answer. So, for 36 straight hours, I drank and ate and gambled like it was my last 2 days on Earth. I felt no fear. We went to strip clubs where I paid strippers to convince me that I was the hottest, funniest, sweetest guy they'd ever met. And I believed it. At one point at the Crazy Horse 2, a topless waitress came by with a tray that held a dozen test tubes filled with brightly colored booze. Here's how it worked. For $20, you could buy a shot. Then one of the strippers, who all had cute stripper names like Destiny or Felony or Alimony, would take the test tube, tilt her head back, and lower the bottom end into her mouth. Then she'd climb onto your lap and tower above you and tilt her head down until you took the open end of the test tube into your mouth, and then you'd both lady in the trumpet as the booze ran down your throat. I must have done that 10 times with 10 different strippers in the course of 10 minutes. From what I've been told, I tipped very well that night. On the drive back home on Sunday, my headache and nausea slowly gave way to a painful electric anxiety. Sure, a weekend of relentless rebellion and self-destruction was fun, but now that it was over, real life was still there. And in 2 months, I'd still be getting on an airplane and flying to Salt Lake City with Susan. I was 36, and I was acting like I was 17, and I was feeling like I was 5. I was scared. I was angry. I wanted to cry. I watched the barren desert roll past all around me and wondered, who am I really rebelling against? And who can I go to for comfort? You know what? How about making 2026 the year that changes everything? A lot of you have reached out asking for help with your personal creative projects. So finally, after 30 years in the business, I'm making myself available really to whoever needs help. Maybe you're writing a TV pilot or a movie. Maybe you're trying your hand at memoir. You want to tell the story of your life, kind of like this podcast. Or maybe it's a novel or a short story or a graphic novel. Look, whatever it is, they say endings are hard, but really getting started is even harder. And that's where I come in. Go to richardhaddam.com and click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room. I can help you with brainstorming sessions. Maybe you're halfway through something and you're stuck. I can read what you've got so far, help you bring it to the finish line. Or I can read a finished script or a story and help you get it into professional shape so you can finally send it out into the world. Go to richardhaddam.com, click on Richard Haddam's Writer's Room, and let's get to work. Mention that you heard about it on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf, and you'll instantly get a 20% discount, okay? Working with me isn't free, it's not even cheap, but it's worth it. Don't wait any longer. Now's the time to make your dreams come true. Get unstuck at Richard Haddam's Writer's Room at richardhaddam.com. And now, back to the show. The survivors and victims of Flight 401 were evenly distributed throughout the plane. There seemed to be no rhyme or reason in who lived and who died. In one seat, a passenger would be relatively uninjured, while in the next, a passenger would have disappeared completely, only to be found days later, dead of massive bodily impact. Many survivors had their clothes torn from their bodies from the blast of a single fireball that traveled the length of the fuselage. Others found themselves injured or trapped in immediate danger of drowning in what was often only a foot or two of water. All found themselves covered in jet fuel, and surviving flight attendants yelled into the darkness to anyone who might be able to hear, "Do not light any matches or flares." And miraculously, no one did. Passengers groped their way through the wreckage in the cold, dark swamp, sometimes seriously injuring themselves on jagged pieces of the wrecked airliner. They grouped together and tried to aid whoever seemed most in need, but there was almost nothing they could do for one another besides wait for help. To keep spirits up, flight attendants began singing Christmas carols. Soon, others joined in. It would be almost 2 hours before an organized rescue effort was underway. First Officer Albert Stockstill died immediately upon impact. Captain Bob Loft also died of his injuries within an hour of the crash. Down in the hellhole, Second Officer Don Repo and Tech Engineer Angelo Donadeo were still alive, and rescuers managed to extract them both and deliver them to local hospitals. While Donadeo experienced a full recovery, Repo died of his injuries 31 hours later on the last day of 1972. The first appearance of Repo's ghost was just 3 months later. It was in the galley of plane number 318 on the Miami to New York leg of the Eastern Airlines flight that still carried the route number 401. Stewardess Ginny Packard was below deck, sending full carts of hot meals up the small service elevator when it happened. From the book, quote, "Out of the corner of her eye, she became aware of a hazy, cloud-like formation just in front of the bulkhead wall. Puzzled, she turned to look at it. It seemed to be about the size of a grapefruit, but it was getting bigger. It was also pulsating in a strange way. She turned her face away and pressed the elevator button. Perhaps if I don't look at it, she said to herself, it might go away. But she could still see the shape out of the corner of her eye. She looked again. It was more pronounced than ever. It was clearly forming into a face, with dark hair, gray at the sides, and steel-rimmed glasses. There was no question that it was a face, and no question that it was wearing glasses. This was the final touch, the steel-rimmed glasses, that removed any uncertainty from her mind. Ginny Packard recognized the face. It was a pilot she had worked with more than once, a man who had died 3 months ago. It was Don Repo. Ginny was deeply shaken by what she had seen, but she was the only one who had seen it. She knew she hadn't imagined it, but she also knew she couldn't explain it. Feeling very alone, she decided not to tell anyone. And she didn't. Not then, anyway. That was March of 1973. Then, in April, there was a far more disturbing event on plane number 318. And this one was witnessed by no less than 3 Eastern Airlines employees and half a dozen first-class passengers. The senior stewardess for the flight, Sis Patterson, was doing a routine headcount when she came across an unaccounted-for passenger in first class, a man in an Eastern Airlines captain's uniform. This in itself wasn't strange. Captains would often hitch a ride on returning flights to their home airports if their schedules demanded it. This was a practice ironically referred to as deadheading. They might start the flight in first class, then later move up to the jump seat in the cockpit, joining the flight crew. Sis asked the captain if she should check him off as first class or jump seat for her passenger list, but she got no response. The captain just stared forward blankly as if he hadn't heard her. Flight supervisor Diane Boaz joined Sis and was equally puzzled when the captain wouldn't respond to her either. He seemed normal in all respects, except for the fact that he wouldn't engage with them in any way. Finally, they alerted the flight captain, who left the cockpit to see what the problem was. From the book, the flight captain leaned down to address the other captain. Then he froze. "My God, it's Bob Loft," he said. There was silence in the cabin. Then something happened that no one in the vicinity could explain. The captain in the first class seat simply wasn't there. He was there one moment and not there the next. There was a long delay as the plane was searched. The missing captain, could not be found anywhere. When Ginny Packard heard the story, she was actually relieved. Now she wasn't the only one with a strange story to tell. Now, these stories were personally related to John Fuller by the Eastern Airlines flight attendants who experienced them: Ginny Packard, Denise Woodruff, and Doris Elliott. By the way, all the names of the Eastern Airline employees are pseudonyms. They all requested total anonymity, and we're going to find out why in just a second. Denise and Doris were only secondhand witnesses to the story of Bob Loft's full-body apparition in the first-class cabin of, once again, plane number 318. Several days later, Denise and Doris were excited when they were assigned to plane 318. From the book, quote, "This would give them a legitimate chance to check the plane's logbook, where every incident, minor or major, had to be recorded according to FAA regulation. These reports accumulated in the official logbook over an extended period of time and became a permanent part of the aircraft's record." Before they boarded the plane for their assigned flight, Denise and Doris went to the crew's scheduling office to talk to Hal Griffin, a friend of theirs, to get more definite information about the uncanny story of the disappearing captain. As a crew scheduler, Hal was able to confirm the story that they had heard. The entire flight crew had left the plane and reported the incident and entered it into the log. This confirmation by the crew scheduler was more than Doris and Denise expected. As soon as they boarded plane number 318, they went to check the logbook. But when they opened it, they noticed something very strange. All the pages up to and including the date of the incident had been removed, contrary to general practice. The comments recorded by the captain and crew of that unusual flight were now completely missing. And here is where we need to talk about a major factor in this book's overall credibility. No matter how hard he tried, John Fuller was unable to verify the firsthand witness accounts of the supernatural events that supposedly occurred on the L-1011s because he had no access to any written records. And since the employees were all afraid of retaliation by Eastern Airlines, none were willing to allow him to use their real names. Many had already been threatened with psychiatric evaluations or termination. It will not surprise you to hear that the upper management of Eastern Airlines all denied that there were any paranormal events on any of their planes. The party line was basically that the ghost stories were just gossip cooked up by a bunch of dizzy dames. Look, in truth, I think it would be too much to expect officials from a major airline to indulge any talk of a haunted airplane. They had enough on their plate simply reassuring the public that their planes were safe and reliable despite what happened in the Everglades. Fuller realizes he has a problem, but he reports the stories that are being related to him because he instinctually trusts the sources, and at a certain juncture, he realizes he has bigger fish to fry. Ultimately, this is a story about the existence of life after death. And the Eastern Airlines Public Relations Office notwithstanding, he keeps getting reports from pilots, engineers, flight attendants, and other employees in this most modern field who all absolutely believe that they are working side by side with ghosts. He knows he's hit a tipping point when he learns of a pilot who attempted a kind of amateur exorcism to rid plane number 318 of the ghost of Don Repo. "I was in an old stone building on Colorado Boulevard, sitting outside a door, waiting to see a woman. Susan knew nothing about it. The woman's name was Karen. Karen Meiselman." Okay, Karen Meiselman, PhD. She was a therapist, but more important, she was also a hypnotist. "My therapist had recommended her to me after several weeks of hearing me whine about being afraid of flying and more or less demanding a quick solution. There were things about hypnosis that interested me. The thing that interested me the most was that it seemed like magic. It seemed easy. Karen took me through some relaxation exercises. I was supposed to imagine myself in a safe, calm place. She told me that other patients often pictured themselves in a cabin in the woods. But I already had my place, and I'd had it since childhood. It was inside my bookshelf, in the space behind the books. I would imagine myself very small in a cozy bed tucked into that dark, quiet space with the books rising up on my right. Above them, faint yellow candlelight from the room below flickered against the back wall of the shelf. I could hear people in other parts of the house going about their lives, but I was completely hidden and no one even knew I was there. Thinking about this had always worked in the past, but for some reason, it wasn't working now. Just as I was about to sink down, 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 I'd start swimming up, up, up. I was afraid, afraid to trust Dr. Meiselman, afraid of losing control. She gave me some cassette tapes to take home and practice with at night as I lay in bed, but the effect was the same. Once relaxing became a critical goal, I couldn't do it. After four sessions, I knew it was hopeless. I couldn't let myself give in to the process. I found myself resisting it more and more, rebelling against her attempts to calm and comfort me. After the fourth session, I stopped showing up altogether. It was now the first week of January, which meant that I was having my yearly physical. Dr. Marsh was just about to begin my prostate exam. "Now, if you can feel both of my hands on your shoulders," he said, "you know something's wrong." I laughed because, you know, he was about to stick his finger up my butt, and we're guys. I'll give Dr. Marsh this. He was extremely fast. And as soon as he was done, he said, "You're fine, no signs of enlargement, no cancer." Was it as good for you as it was for me? Later, as he was going over my EKG results, he looked up and asked me, "What's wrong?" The question shocked me. Shouldn't he be telling me what was wrong? "You seem stressed," he said. He could tell this from the EKG? I suddenly said, "Look, it's so stupid. I'm supposed to go on a trip with Susan in a couple of weeks, but for some reason, I don't know, I'm really stressing out about the airplane." I went on making excuses until he raised his right hand, stopping me in mid-sentence. "Have you tried Xanax? My wife hates flying. She takes it every time we travel." I was stunned. Xanax. The word had such an exotic sound, like the name of a genie. "What is Xanax?" I asked. "It's an anti-anxiety muscle relaxant," he said. "You take it 30 minutes before takeoff, you go to sleep." This is how he talked. Straightforward, no bullshit. A plus B equals C. What goes up must come down. "And it works," I said. "Of course it works," he said. "We've been to Europe, we've been to China, we've been to Australia. She sleeps, I read a book. It's a wonderful drug." I wasn't so sure. Drugs had never been my thing, and neither had drinking until just a few years earlier. For me, giving up control was terrifying. And ironically, giving up control was what was making me afraid of flying. But now I'd be on a plane and on drugs? Maybe that wasn't such a good idea. "One thing," he said as he tore the sheet off the prescription pad. "Don't fight it." "What do you mean, don't fight it?" "Your hypervigilance is part of the problem," he said. "You think you're responsible for making sure the plane doesn't crash. So when the drug starts to work and you start to relax, your brain kicks in and you start to fight the drug. Don't do that. Just let it do its thing." He handed me the prescription. I looked at it in my hand. "Don't fight it," I thought. Like the way you fought hypnosis. Taking a serious, mood-altering drug felt decadent, forbidden. I mean, who was I? Ozzy Osbourne? Maybe this could be part of my adolescent rebellion. Or would I rebel against the drug? I was starting to get confused. But the fact was, the clock was ticking. Susan and I were leaving on our trip that weekend. Xanax was my last hope. "Oh God, please," I thought, "please let this work. Please, Mr. Xanax, make me not scared. Make me calm. I won't fight you. I promise I won't fight you." The pilot who attempted to exorcise the ghost of Don Repo from plane number 318 was Dick Manning, also a pseudonym and a damn good one. Dick had heard the stories of Loft and Repo appearing on plane number 318. At this point, they had been going on for well over a year. Now, Manning was a devout Christian, but he also believed in the biblical validity of apparitions. During a layover in Miami, he boarded plane number 318 early and headed straight down to the galley. He brought with him a small cup of holy water. Here is the story he told John Fuller. Quote, "The moment I got down there in the galley, the lights started flickering on and off. I sanctified the galley with a cup of holy water. I sprinkled it around and around the area. As I did so, a wind started blowing down there. It grew cold. It was like standing inside a deep freeze. I sensed a presence in the room, and then a shape began to form. It kept fading in and out. It formed enough for me to recognize the features of Don Repo. I said to him, 'Don't you know that you're dead? You have lost your life. Your spirit remains here, but you have not taken your rightful place where you belong.' Then I said, 'In the name of Jesus, by his blood, you are begone from here. I am calling an angel of light, and he shall take you to the place that you belong.' Then, where the shape of Don Repo was standing, there was a light, a very bright luminescence. It was so bright I had to turn my face away. Then everything was gone. He was no longer there." Manning was bold enough in his belief to actually tell other airline employees what he had done. And guess what? Eventually it got around to his supervisor, who called him into his office to talk about it. He was clearly disturbed by the story going around and wanted to know if it was true. To his credit, Manning admitted everything. In his mind, he had done both Don Repo and Eastern Airlines a favor. If what he did worked, and he thought that it had, it meant that Repo had gone on to his final reward and the ghost stories would finally end. From the book, quote, "The supervisor said to Manning, 'If I believed, if I really thought that you believed in that, I'd send you down for a psychiatric examination.' Manning looked directly at him and said, 'I believe it, and I dare you.' He was never sent to the psychiatrist." I knew I was going to have to tell Susan about the Xanax. There was no way I was going to secretly take some weird drug right before we got on an airplane without her knowing about it. After all, I had no idea what it was really going to do or if it would even work. As soon as I got back from the pharmacy, I showed her the bottle of pills and explained what Dr. Marsh had told me. "That's wonderful, baby," she said, "but maybe we should try it first so we know what it feels like." I assumed she was using a kind of royal we, like when a nurse says, "How are we feeling today?" But a minute later, Susan was filling two glasses of water, and I realized she planned on taking one too. "Those are my Xanax," I said. "Honey," she said, "if you're doing it, I gotta know what it does." Now things were getting interesting. We were both gonna do drugs, like Sid and Nancy. What if Mr. Xanax had other properties? You know what I mean? What if it was a sexy drug? We decided to try it while watching the movie we had rented. A little something called The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. Oh yes, this could be a very interesting night. I woke up 4 hours later. Somehow the movie was still going. People were fighting each other and trees in Helm's Deep, I think. And for some reason, I kept muttering potatoes over and over and over again. But I felt good. I felt calm, at peace. I cautiously began searching every corner of my mind for something to worry about. I found all the usual stuff, except for some reason, none of it worried me. And I welcomed the feeling. I didn't fight it. I looked over at Susan. She was asleep too, so I leaned over and whispered in her ear, "Potatoes." She woke up and stared at me and then at the television. "Did we miss it?" "I think so," I said. But the movie kept going on for a few more hours. Finally, we turned it off and went to bed and slept. I never expected the story of the ghost of Flight 401 to end with John Fuller and his stewardess girlfriend Elizabeth talking to the ghost of Don Repo on a Ouija board in a hotel room, but here we are. I don't think John Fuller expected it either, but at some point, he too had decided not to fight it. If this whole investigation was morphing into a story of unprovable witness accounts, or what skeptics would rightly call anecdotal evidence, then why not try for some anecdotal evidence of his own? Fuller needed to find out what he believed, and that needed to become greater than tracking down some Eastern Airlines deep throat in the executive ranks who would confirm with some kind of proof that there was an actual cover-up going on and that firsthand reports inside the flight logs had been intentionally scuttled. For him, the question boiled down to, are the people who feel they have communicated with the ghost of Don Repo crazy? Like so many before and after him, Fuller thought of himself as the ultimate paragon of sanity. If he could experience what they had experienced, then they weren't crazy because he wasn't crazy. And if along the way he gathered information through the Ouija board that could be confirmed as factually accurate, so much the better. John and Elizabeth bought a Ouija board at a local department store and then retired to a private hotel room to conduct their first experiment. Fuller considered night one of their experiment a failure. They appeared to make contact with some energy or spirit that claimed to be Don Repo, but the answers they received to their questions were things they already knew or had strongly suspected. In other words, they could have been subconsciously controlling the Ouija board's planchette and doing nothing more than talking to themselves. Night two was different. Don Repo came through with a request. Go phone Donna. Donna, they discovered, was the name of one of Repo's daughters. Elizabeth asked what message Don would like them to give Donna, and the Ouija board replied, I love her. Forget Don. Tears don't help me come back. This message chilled Fuller. Tears don't help me come back? It wasn't factual or verifiable, but it sounded and felt so human, so personal. Fuller tried to get everything back on a professional level. He asked Repo to mention some things he did on his pre-flight checklist. This was information Fuller didn't know, but could easily check. Repo's response? Wheels, visual, nose gear, tires, be good girl phone Donna, tell her. Then, without prompting, the planchette began a series of violent moves that seemed to produce a message of gibberish. The pilot Everglades friend had more hurt for us pilots and Eastern crew in their house. The girl see me in galley oven. Did mice leave that family closet? John and Elizabeth couldn't make any sense out of the pilot Everglades friend had more hurt for us pilots and Eastern crew in their house. The most coherent bit seemed to be the girls see me in galley oven, but then again, that was information they were both quite familiar with. And the last words, did mice leave that family closet, seemed to be a complete non sequitur. Then suddenly, another strange phrase came through. To go into wastebasket, pennies, sit there, boys' room. The message that Fuller grappled with most was the one about phoning Donna, Repo's daughter. Up until this point, he had not directly approached the families of any of the flight crew. He had no idea how they were processing their grief from the loss of their family members or what their religious beliefs were. So the last thing he wanted to do was upset them with questions about information he may have received from a dead loved one through a Ouija board. But Repo had been insistent. The message had been repeated several times throughout the session. Finally, John Fuller settled on what he felt was a fair compromise. He wrote Donna a letter. Here it is. Quote, Dear Donna Repo, I'm in the process of writing a story on the L-1011 tragedy, which in no way will reflect badly on the flight crew or Eastern Airlines. The underlying theme of the story is very simple. The fragility of life and the importance of life after death. In the background research I've done, I've of course come across a tremendous amount of material regarding the reappearances of the flight crew of Flight 401 in the galley and elsewhere on plane number 318 and several others. This material in turn bears heavily on the theme. I'd very much like to share with you some of the material I've come across in my many months of research, much of it turned up by Elizabeth Manzioni, my research assistant who's been a cabin attendant for Northwest Orient Airlines for the past 7 years. Both of us would like to meet you and have you as our guest for dinner when we come to Miami within the next few weeks. 1 week later, the letter came back unopened and stamped, "Return to sender, no such number." It took John a few days to track down the address of Donna's mother, Don Repo's widow, and he resent the letter there, to Donna, care of the new address. 4 days later, he received a call from Donna, who had a strange story to tell. From the book, "Your letter arrived at my mother's house, and she brought it over to me. I opened the letter and read it later after she left. Frankly, I didn't want to talk about the story. I was about to throw the letter away when I got a call from my mother. She had mentioned that your name sounded familiar, and she was trying to think of where she had seen it before. Then she remembered she had just read a book of yours, Arrigo, Surgeon of the Rusty Knife. So she called me and said she was very interested in talking to you. She wants to share with you some of the experiences she's had since the time of the accident. They're very strange. So we'd be glad to take you up on your dinner invitation." When John and Elizabeth met with Donna and Alice the following week, he was relieved to confirm that they knew all about the stories about Don's ghost, and rather than being hurt or offended, they were eager to hear everything John had discovered in his research. John told them about the stories he heard from flight attendants and stewardesses. He even talked about Dick Manning and his impromptu exorcism. He put it off as long as he could, but finally he knew he was going to have to ask Alice about the mice. From the book, "This might seem like a crazy question to you, but did you ever have any trouble with mice in what you call your family closet?" Both Donna and Alice looked startled. "How do you know about that?" "Just a couple of months ago, some mice built a nest in the attic above what we call our family room. We couldn't get rid of them for quite some time. Finally, my son John set a bunch of traps. And actually, it wasn't the family closet, it was the family room, and the only way you could get through to the attic was through the family room closet. But how did you ever hear about that?" I told Alice that I'd tell her after I asked her another crazy question. "Did Don have anything to do with some pennies in a wastebasket in your boys' room?" "This is amazing," Alice said. "Don used to collect Indian head pennies. There was a small barrel full of them in my son's room. But who told you about this? I'm curious." Ultimately, John Fuller explained to them about the Ouija board sessions he and Elizabeth had conducted. One way or another, the answer was obvious. The person who told them these details was the ghost of Don Repo. And if Don Repo's ghost could be summoned through a Ouija board, who was to say it couldn't manifest itself in the glass door of a galley oven, or form itself into being from something that looked like oily smoke, but quickly resolved into the recognizable form of a specific human being? It was in this moment that John finally accepted that the stories he and Elizabeth had been investigating were probably true. Unprovable, but true nonetheless. In short, he stopped fighting it. And whatever his notions were about his personal feelings never getting in the way of his journalistic professionalism, well, those modified themselves a bit too. Soon after the book was published, he and Elizabeth were married. They worked on books together and lived their lives together until John joined Repo and Loft and Stockstill when he died 14 years later on November 7th, 1990. It was the pennies and the mice that finally convinced John that there might be something that lives on after death. But as far as Loft and Repo were concerned, after those exciting Ouija board sessions, between John and Elizabeth, where hope and love were born, neither Loft or Repo were ever heard from again. I have flown at least twice a year for the last 22 years, and I have my routine down pat. I take one Mr. Xanax half an hour before takeoff, and I spend most of the flight asleep. I don't try to go down into the galley. I don't stare at the oven doors and the food prep vestibules. I don't look too hard at the uniformed deadheaders in first class. And I don't worry about airplanes anymore. On that flight back from Salt Lake City all those years ago, I settled in next to Susan and waited for the drug to kick in. And I didn't fight it. We'd had an amazing weekend, truly magical. And when I was with her, I never wanted to be with anyone else. It was hard to even imagine being with anyone else. Why didn't I ever feel like I needed to rebel against Susan? Then, as the drug took hold and my anxiety dissolved like mist, I thought, what if Susan is my rebellion? What if she's all the girls I never slept with? All the steamy one-night stands, all the careless hookups at parties, the illicit acts in the VIP lounge, all the wild, drunk, and fumbling makeout sessions and hallways and staircases and elevators, all the things I never did. My mind drifted back and forth like a falling leaf, sinking further and further into a vast, dark ocean of love. Maybe Susan's all the rebellion I'll ever need, I thought. Maybe I'll just rebel with her forever. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we go deep into the woods on the eternal hunt for Sasquatch. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.